Just before we start this episode of Not Enough Champagne, this has strong language from the outset. So if you do have any small children, just, you know, cover their ears. Legend has it that Lyndon Johnson is in one of his early congressional campaigns. Told one of his aides to spread a story that his opponent enjoyed intimate relationships with the pigs on his farm. "Christ, Lyndon, we can't call the guy a pig fucker. It ain't true," replied his aide. To which Lyndon Johnson apparently replied, "Of course it ain't true, but I just want the son of a bitch to deny it." There's lots of talk nowadays that we're living in an age of post-truth politics. But I think what the Lyndon Johnson anecdote shows quite clearly is that there's never been a golden age of truth in political discourse. Hunter S. Thompson repeated the anecdote I've just told you in Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, his book on the 72 election, and he quite rightly says that Johnson's tactic was one of the oldest tricks in politics, in that you say a ridiculous thing to try and get your opponent to deny it, which then gives the thing more airplay. We talked about this last week with the Leave campaign's figure of £350 million a week that Britain sends to the EU, and you were saying that when the Remain campaign deny the figure, they give a different figure. It just ends up
looking like it's still a big figure, and you're still repeating the initial claim.
Exactly. But I think what's clear, maybe from 2016, whether it's money in the Brexit vote, whether it's the rise and eventual fall of Donald Trump, on the eve of the US election, what we're asking in this episode is this a golden age of political bullshit? Swift wrote an essay on political lying in the 18th century. There's nothing new about political lying, but maybe I think what's different now is the way that what Stephen Colbert calls truthiness. That truthiness essentially is,
it doesn't have to be true, it just has to look like it's true.
Yeah, and you have to feel like it is true, essentially. It kind of comes from the gut. And you kind of saw this a little bit about the Republican convention. There were lots of kind of a dark attacks from people like Newt Gingrich and from Rudy Giuliani on how American cities like Chicago were becoming lawless, despite the fact that violent crime in America has been going down for years.
And in those cities.
But Newt Gingrich kept making the point that it's what people feel. It's about whether the fear of crime is going up, not about the actual crime figures. To that end, there's a couple of quite interesting blogs online by two political scientists, John Hopkin and Ben Rosamond, on the art of political bullshit. Bullshit is different to lying. If you tell a lie, you're deliberately trying to tell an untruth. Whereas bullshit, you don't really care about the truth. A bullshitter does not submit his claim to the court of truth. So you can't just refute the facts. That does not work with a seasoned bullshitter. The example that John Hopkin and Ben Rosamond give is the narrative on what caused our infamous deficit, and the line that is built up after 2008 in that the deficit was built caused by Labour's profligacy and that overspending, which is bullshit. The financial crisis wasn't caused by overspending. It doesn't seem to matter. You still end up with this bullshit that is keeps being disseminated and keeps being believed is true.
The polite word for all of this is narrative.
Well, I said the point they make is that the reason why the deficit claim was winning or flourished is because it flourished in the context of deficit fetishism, is what they call it. So there's the focus on balanced budgets and anxiety. I suppose it's similar to what we were talking about last week in the EU referendum, where the referendum ended up being about immigration, not the economy. Once you have a narrative of wanting to be tough on deficits, this kind of bullshit claim gets a bit of traction.
Yeah, essentially that is where it goes. I mean, in politics, being able to set that narrative is potentially the most powerful thing that you have. which is why governments tend to do much better than oppositions in terms of elections, and why governments don't change at the drop of a hat normally. And the reason for that is because governments set the agenda, governments are able to set those narratives. One of the reasons that Labour struggled in the 2015 election was they had a very elongated leadership election, which...
Thank heavens we learned from that lesson.
Yeah, which dragged out over
three months.
And during those 3 months, the Tories and the Lib Dems and government were saying, oh, Labour overspent. And they had no leader, so they had no one setting an alternative narrative, which meant that idea that Labour overspent seeped into the consciousness, which meant come 2015, when Ed Miliband was saying, okay, no, we get that we overspent. One, they admitted it, which they shouldn't have. And two, they then still didn't offer very much in terms of here's how we'll fund stuff.
Well, I slightly disagree, because in one of the question times before the referendum, Ed Miliband was asked, do you think that Labour overspent? And he said, no, I don't think so. And there were audible gasps from the audience, because this idea has been so ingrained. And as you say, not challenged. And there were some people in the Labour leadership election in 2015, I think Liz Kendall and Andy Burnham both came out and said that they kind of admitted that Labour spends too much money. I think almost to try and put the issue to bed and say, yes, okay, we did, we'll move on. But I don't think that will work, because...
You're buying into that narrative.
You're buying in. Yeah, you're buying into
absolutely.
Bullshit, basically.
But again, this is something that's quite not new. I mean, Tony Blair had to have a landmark item and a news piece in the form of, we're getting rid of Clause 4 in order to demonstrate that Labour had changed. This is the thing, when you let narratives build up, it needs something iconic to actually happen, or something that's so out of the ordinary for the party
maybe to
shift it.
Maybe Labour could have put their election pledges on stone. And I know that. They tried that.
Was that a fever dream, or did that actually happen?
After 2016, actually, it seems like quite a sensible thing to do. It is easy to put the claims of overspending in a nice, easy narrative as well. It's easy. We've talked a bit before about heuristics, about how voters are, I mean, we could call them rationally ignorant, maybe. They don't spend a lot of time looking at the ins and outs of macroeconomic policy, because they have lives, and who can blame them? So if you're looking at a convenient narrative and you're looking at what you think is to blame for the deficit, are you going to listen to a couple of economists with beards who say that actually it's fine, and start giving you a lecture on Keynesian counter-cyclical spending?
Or are you going to listen to the guy on the TV who looks very telegenic and is very charismatic?
I was going to say George Osborne, but we can go with him if you like, but George Osborne saying that Labour didn't fix the roof when the sun was shining, which I think is a very
good metaphor.
Yeah, and kind of talking about hardworking families, like, it plays into, it hits all the right buttons.
Yeah.
Something I read, again, it's in the articles I've talked about. I don't know quite how I feel about it. It says that they're wondering if bullshit has a conservative bias. There's some research suggesting conservatives are less comfortable with complex and ambiguous information.
Yeah, it's one of those things where research like this is always, to be honest, a bit iffy. Just in terms, just because it seems to imply all conservatives are dumb, and it's like that's not what's being said at all. Good kind of studies on this. They aren't just looking at things in the left-right spectrum, as in left-wing, you know, socialism versus right-wing conservatism. What they are looking at is conservatism as a character trait amongst a whole host of other character traits. And on that regard, actually, you find that, for instance, a number of people who are well on the left also exhibit kind of like high levels of being conservative opposed to change. Jeremy Corbyn would be one such person, for instance. Same with John McDonnell. If you've got studies which show that kind of stuff, then it becomes a lot better to look at, because it's easy to see and show bullshit narratives on both the left and the right, which are incredibly simplistic and offer no real actual solutions to anything.
I mean, there was a Hopi Sen kind of, he said, well, you can say that the counter argument to what Osborne is saying is that actually with the coalition cuts, they kind of threw away the protective awning of the house in the middle of a hurricane, essentially. And, you know, it's about, I think, developing left-wing bullshit or an alternative narrative which hasn't quite been done. And there was even, I mean, Chris Mullin's diaries are quite interesting during the dying days of the Brown government. The fact that this economic crisis was caused by a lack of regulation, when actually the Cameron and Osborne were berating Brown for not going further in deregulation. Then Gordon Brown, as he said himself, saved the world, not the banks, was instrumental in leading the bailout, which Cameron and Osborne opposed in opposition. Gave Labour no traction at all on the campaign trail. And so I wonder if it's maybe, you know, maybe it's partly if the Labour, if the media has taken against a government, almost it doesn't matter, they have the narrative set. And to be fair, there's a lot of evidence for the narrative set is that Gordon Brown's government was chaotic, running out of ideas. Nothing could save them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before we go on to our next section, please, 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 I know we say this every week, I know every podcast says this, but please could you rate us and subscribe us on iTunes if you like what we do. Please could you share and tell anyone you like, however you would like.
If you start doing this, then we might actually stop asking.
We're never going to stop asking.
No, we're never going to stop asking, but do it anyway.
If Nick Clegg told us anything, is that you should never make promises you cannot keep. I'm not going to be photographed with a pledge saying
I will stop asking for reviews.
Yeah, exactly. But please share us. I tweet at Paperback Rioter. Steve is at Centre Radical. Please let us know what you think. If you've got, we're thinking of ideas for a new season in the new year. If you've got anything you'd like us to talk about, please let us know. So we definitely need to take bullshit seriously. We're not going to talk too much about Trump's particular brand of bullshit, partly because we're recording this in mid-October and the chances of him making even more outrageous claims between now and early November
are almost certain.
I'd say more certain than almost certain.
It's like between a value of 0 and 1, we're at 0.99.
Yeah, so occurring. We'll talk about that when we talk about the US election next week. There's an independent article that said British public wrong about nearly everything.
Yeah.
Which has some quite celebrated statistics about, for instance, the fact that the British public think that 24% of Social Security spending is fraud, is on benefit fraud. The real figure is 0.7%. We concentrate more on that £1.2 billion of benefit fraud rather than £25 billion on tax avoidance, and that the electorate continually overestimate the percentage of Muslims in the country, of ethnic minorities in the country, of immigrants in the country. Now, there's that on the one hand, in that you've got voters who are making judgments without the correct facts. On the other hand, there's some evidence in political science which says that although political opinion isn't good on specific things, on general trends, actually, it's quite perceptive. So if you, for instance, track public concern over about immigration in polls with the amount of net immigration into the country, there's a very, very strong correlation. So as net immigration increases, concern of immigration increases, and as it goes down, concern goes down. So how much does it matter that the public don't know the facts, or is it just important that generally we know it in the particular, that we know it in the general and not the particular?
Well, this is one of those quite interesting little things where there's a bit of counterintuitiveness actually happening with all this. So, like immigration, for instance, people are generally concerned about immigration, which has led the Conservative government to try and crack down on it, which has led to things like students' visas being much harder to come by and things like that. And yet, when you actually dig down into the views of the public at large, they actually are quite sophisticated and break up immigrants into good and bad kinds. Students, they've classed as good immigrants. And there are other immigrants who, like, for instance, people coming over here, stealing our jobs, doing low-skilled manual work, which, you know, young people or whatever other British people would be doing, those are considered, more generally speaking, to be bad immigrants. You actually have a British public which is quite on the ball in terms of differentiating between things. Disagree or agree with it as you will, but those distinctions are made.
I mean, we talked about this in our previous podcast, didn't we, when we talked about people's views on immigration, that actually you've got some pro-immigration Leave voters, people like Dan Hannan, you've got some anti-immigration Remain voters, and generally most British people are in the middle.
Yeah.
And there's cultural concerns that you can address.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, maybe it's just that political parties Maybe the public are more nuanced than political parties on this issue, because the Conservatives have gone straight down the rabbit hole of
immigration, and the Lib Dems have gone in the opposite direction, trying to climb up the stairs to be the complete opposite.
Yeah.
And Labour are kind of floundering, trying to work out what to do at the moment.
Well, Labour's position, as I understand, and it probably hasn't changed in the 3 or 4 weeks since this podcast were there. Apparently, Corbyn's position is that we are in favour of free movement of labour, but we are against being in a single market, which, as far as I can see, is if you had the worst position you could possibly choose, that's going to piss off Leave voters and Remain voters.
If you had to design a policy which would piss off everyone, it would be that.
What is the opposite of the Holy Grail? Not even a poison chalice, just a chalice made of shit that Jeremy Corbyn has grasped. We are the 4.8%. Maybe. Is the solution to bullshit then, sadly, to try and manufacture more bullshit for ourselves? Is it to come up with decent narratives on immigration?
There has always been an attempt to try and defeat bullshit with rationality, to throw facts and figures and logic at bullshit. And it does not work. The Political Brain by, is it Drew Weston?
Drew Weston, yeah.
By Drew Weston, outlines quite nicely how people think and view politics. And it's all about emotional appeal. It's all about the shared values. It's all about the complete opposite of logic and reason and evidence. So, yes, the only way to actually fight those things is with your own brand of bullshit. You know, in the hope that maybe, just maybe if we're lucky, we end up with a situation where the thesis of anti-immigration being anti-immigration meets the antithesis of being pro-immigration, and we end up with a hypothesis in the middle which actually functions. The reality is, who knows if that can happen. I think what I just described there was like part of Hegel's kind of notion of how ideas develop, which is, you know, sounds wonderful. Based on logic, not based on emotion, though.
He was probably an expert as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Discount his views.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, so really it does boil down to developing strong narratives which do tell the stories that you want to tell. So, for instance, I think one of the things that the Remain campaign should have done when immigration, it became obvious that immigration was going to be an issue, was to bung up billboards everywhere with a picture of multiracial, kind of a very diverse kind of people wearing lab coats, stethoscopes, nurses' uniforms, all that kind of stuff. And the message is simple: no immigration, no NHS. Because we don't produce enough doctors, we don't produce enough nurses. So if you don't have those people, the NHS does not function. And that would have been a way to present an alternative narrative about immigration, focusing on the positive things that they did. Yes, I mean, that kind of summary I did is a bit negative rather than optimistic, but, you know, it would have at least offered an alternative view,
again,
rather than just kind of going, oh, well, yes, actually, there's not a lot we can do about that. Yes, they're good for the economy, but it's like, being good for the economy is an abstract concept for most people. And if you try and make a point where, say, actually it gives you an extra £3.50 a day or however much a year, you kind of go, really? How does having the Polish builder deliver money in my pocket? It doesn't. But if you put it into something which people really like the NHS, you've got a much stronger case to make.
And it's about playing on people's hopes and fears, as we suggested with the podcast last week on Project Fear. There are ways that you can play to people's fears successfully, there are ways playing to people's hopes successfully. How easy is that in the media climate we have, though? I mean, Peter Oberon wrote a book called The Rise of Political Lying.
Yeah.
And like a lot of Peter Oberon's work, very similar to the Labour hard left, actually, he kind of blames everything that ever went wrong with the country on Tony Blair. Blair and New Labour for this kind of, the spin doctors and the kind of, we could call it the bullshit industry, maybe, that built up around it. A bit like Oberon's The Triumph of the Political Class. It's an interesting argument, and there's a grain of truth to it, but it's a little bit anti-historical, because I think what Oberon forgets is the hounding that people like Neil Kinnock got from the Tory media in the 80s and 90s. I mean, the hounding that Ed Miliband, even Jeremy Corbyn, get now, and that you kind of need to fight fire with fire. You need your spin doctor who's going to try and present alternative narratives.
Yeah,
and present spin.
I think the context of which you're operating, such as like friendly or hostile media, in effect, is one of the biggest issues you're going to have at developing an alternative
narrative to something. I mean, let's continue with immigration as the issue. The Sun, largely anti-immigration. The Express is rabidly anti-immigration. The Telegraph is kind of anti-immigration, but in a different way to the other two. The Times is pro-immigration for the business case for it. But it's still kind of, it will kind of lean still rightwards and be, well, maybe freedom of movement for other people that aren't like coming over here for jobs already isn't a good thing. How the hell do you present a pro-immigration argument when most of the press, I didn't even mention the Daily Mail.
What's their position on immigrants, Steve?
Remind me.
I think
they might be anti.
I've not read it in a while. Yeah. We might have to go back,
yeah.
Maybe.
But yeah, there's, when you have the vast bulk of the press being anti-immigration, it does present a significant challenge to you to get out an alternative argument. Part of dealing with that is about presenting the argument in a different way. It's not just enough to say, actually, I think you'll find that 50% of, you know, immigrants add this amount to the economy or whatever,
yeah,
with facts and figures and saying, no, it's good, no, it's good.
Yeah, putting, you have to play on people's,
yeah,
emotions.
And giving out, putting out that press release and putting out the, and just giving another speech on the issue, because it will get ignored. You need to find interesting ways to actually demonstrate it. Off the top of my head, the only way I could think of to do this would be to say, you find some kind of way to organise a strike by immigrants in the NHS and watch the entire thing collapse for a week. That would make the point.
But that depends how that's presented.
Yeah, absolutely. But you get where I'm coming from. It's looking at different ideas. It's like, so that you can actually grab a hold of the narrative. Maybe, you know, what I said there is a bit too far and has lots of backlash potential for it. But doing something where you've got a pressure group, which is all about being pro-immigration, which is funded by pro-immigration people, say, and their action is, we're going to target digital campaigns at people who, from the demographic analysis, we know are have the potential to be pro-immigration but currently aren't. So we're going to find all of these workers in the NHS and we're going to produce a video about them, and they're going to say how wonderful things about how much they love Britain, and then we'll serve that to them. And over time, you are able to do that, but what and able to shift opinion potentially. But how the hell do you get the funding for that? Who the hell's going to run something like that? Political party can't do it, because the minute a political party starts doing it, it becomes, oh well, it's just they're trying to push their agenda rather than an actual kind of pressure group trying to seek change for benefit's sake. So it becomes a very difficult thing to do. But basically, it really just boiled down to campaigning in different ways and trying to come up with interesting ways to make the point. Some of it might work, some of it wouldn't. But over time, you would develop a recipe. The problem is, developing that recipe could take 5, 10, 15 years.
Mm. I think with the press, maybe it's slightly easier now with the rise of social media, I think. I think the hope of those in the Labour Party presumably has to be that, what with the newspaper industry being in crisis, what with declining circulation figures, the fact it's very hard for them to make a profit, that the role of newspapers isn't as important as it was. Now, the figures from the referendum don't suggest that, but it's possible in 5 or 10 years. Depends.
Well, maybe, depending on what you're defining as a newspaper. The reality is, let's use the Daily Mail as an example. It's one of the most read websites in the world. But, you know, so it's...
I think
people still read those editorials. People still read those viewpoints.
True. But I think, I still think the influence of who a newspaper endorses is going to become less over the next few years, because I don't think people go to newspaper websites as much for news nowadays. I think they go to other forms of sites, and maybe just on social media. I think maybe that the big media now maybe is the kind of the broadcast media, your kind of big news channels, and there I think the problem is slightly different. Like, there you've almost got the problem of having to seem objective.
Well, here's the issue with those. I mean, there is that issue of having to seem objective. Don't get me started on like global warming and climate change, where the BBC will still bring on to this day, despite the fact that it has been proven pretty solidly that global warming is an event which is happening, and it is man-made. 99% of the scientific consensus agrees to that.
Hmm.
but they still bring in the one random scientist,
exactly.
The one person. The
it's
person
like having a media debate on.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
It's like, so in that regard, yes, there is a significant issue there with the broadcast media. But also, the broadcast media still get a lot of their lead from the newspapers. Sky, BBC, they don't do investigative journalism, really. They don't break stories in that kind of way. And they still take a lot of their news from what's coming up in the papers.
That's true. And I suppose, adding to that, what seems to be what's still the big story at the moment, I'm guessing it will still be playing out in 3 weeks' time, is the Trump tape in which he talks about grabbing women by...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's not even say that.
Is...
We might have an explicit rating, but we don't want a vulgar one.
Too late was the cry. But yeah. that tape was the product of a good old-fashioned newspaper sting, basically.
Absolutely.
So.
It was. And pretty much everything bad that's come out about Trump has come about as a old-fashioned investigative journalism.
Which newspapers have no money to pay for anymore.
Yeah, they don't have the money to pay for it anymore, but they need to do it, and if they're not doing it, the broadcast journalists won't. Channel 4 will actually go out of its way to dig into Tory expenses. The BBC won't, because the BBC has to be neutral, and if it starts investigating one thing over another, it looks like it's not.
I suppose part of the establishment, as you might say, to quote Owen Jones. We're back next week, hopefully, unless there's been nuclear war since then, and that there might possibly have been. But we'll be back looking back at the US election. I don't want to think about that at the moment, but I'm sure we'll find some interesting things to talk about. Next week we'll be looking back at the US election, or as I prefer to think of it, as the longest and by far the worst series of The West Wing that Aaron Sorkin wrote. Goodbye.